TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. A conversation with Maggie and Arne Gundersen. Friends in Inverness put them up in a cabin in the woods, just a quarter mile from the famous San Andreas earthquake fault. Maggie and Arne Gundersen came to California for a speaking tour at the end of 2015 and offered to meet me in the afternoon before giving a Fukushima update at the Point Reyes Dance Palace. I came down all the way from Mendocino, looking very much forward to meeting them in person. The Gundersens had become so familiar to me for the past 5 years with their fairwinds.org website and as a trusted source of information on the Fukushima disaster. Both worked in the nuclear industry, Maggie in public information, Arne as an engineer and executive. I'm moved by people who question what they're doing, put in time and energy to reform an institution, have the courage to express their criticism, and in Arne's case, risk their livelihood and excellent salary by becoming a whistleblower. Arne was fired from Nuclear Energy Services in 1990. And as you will hear in a moment, Arne and Maggie Gundersen are a close team in the nuclear education work they're now doing. They just recently decided to redefine the word nuclear accident and are coming up with a fascinating reframing. I started by asking them a question that had troubled me for a long time. Given that Arne Gundersen is one of only a handful of whistleblowers, how early did people in the nuclear industry become aware that they were dealing with a monstrously dangerous technology? Here's Maggie Gundersen.
You asked how long we've known about this. I think the nuclear industry knew this from the very beginning. We're finding new papers, new things have been released, documents that show they totally hid things from the American people. Otherwise, these atomic reactors, because that's what they are, whether you change the name to nuclear reactors or nuclear power, they're atomic reactors and they're connected with the atom bomb. And you can't deny that at all.
We met when we worked at a nuclear plant together. And for the first 20 years of my career, I was, you know, senior vice president in the nuclear industry. I found some license violations at the company I worked for. So I told the president of the company this, and he fired me. I told the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and they deliberately botched the inspection, and they were taking bribes. So then John Glenn, Senator John Glenn, took interest in the case and fired up a special inspection. And the inspection found out that all the 6 items that I had brought forward and 2 others had indeed occurred. They found out that the guy who ran the inspection deliberately tried to suppress the information. This is the NRC manager. And that they were taking bribes. So that was 1990. So essentially the first 20 years of my career, I firmly believed in nuclear. But even after that, I believed in nuclear, but I just didn't think it was well regulated. I never really understood how the nuclear industry has co-opted the regulator. And we don't have effective regulation now. So it was Fukushima Daiichi that finally pushed me over. This is a technology that can wipe out a country overnight. Mikhail Gorbachev has said that the accident at Chernobyl was responsible for the collapse of communism. It wasn't perestroika. He actually blames the accident at Chernobyl for, you know, essentially destroying the Soviet empire. And Naoto Kan, who was the prime minister of Japan at the time of the accident, said the same thing. He said that, you know, he looked at the possibility of evacuating 35 million people. How are you going to do that? Accident. We're working on this. We have. Yeah.
We're working on reframing because there is no such thing as a nuclear accident. There are systems in place in which the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the industry assesses how much financial and physical damage and human damage an event in a nuclear plant would do. And so much money or so many people are disposable. That's a good word, disposable. I never knew that when I told people these plants were safe. I never knew that.
Is that the famous cost benefit analysis?
Yes. They use probabilistic risk assessment, PRA. Roll a dice, see what happens, and the odds are. And that's not something you do with human lives or our planetary environment. We have only one Earth, and we can't make it inhabitable for all species.
The way the game is played at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is that they underestimate the probability of a disaster, and they also underestimate the cost to clean it up. So when you do that, of course, nuclear looks pretty darn good. But Fukushima Daiichi showed us that they're incredibly expensive to clean up. When it's over in Japan 100 years from now, they will have spent $500 billion cleaning up from those four reactors. So the price in dollars, let alone the human price, with 1 million cancers in Japan likely before this is all over, just way outweigh whatever benefits you're going to get. But it's our risk and the corporation's benefit. The corporations are making the profit, and we're taking the risk.
Yeah, in your report on the decommissioning of Vermont Yankee, I shouldn't be amazed to find that not only is it a private corporation, many people don't even know that nuclear power is in private hands, but that this is a limited liability corporation. That is so astounding.
I never thought of the fact that nuclear power is in private hands when you have a limited liability corporation, but the nuclear industry has changed over the last 20 years such that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission allowed these plants to be given away to private industry for pennies on the dollar. And private industry made an enormous amount of profit, but they never reinvested that profit back into the power plant. So you get debacles like Vermont Yankee and the leak, or worse yet, the tube failures at San Onofre. And all of those were caused because management was cheap and they didn't do it right. And they didn't want to get the public involved in the licensing process. So the net effect of this privatization of the nuclear industry is that when the plants run, the owners make a lot of money. When the plants break, the public's stuck with the public pain.
Yeah, this whole issue of giving them an enormous trust fund that ratepayers ponied up over time. Not only did they give away the plant for free, they said, here's your bank account.
And at every plant, there's not enough money put aside for decommissioning. Not one plant in the country has enough. So that means the public's going to be tapped again. And that if it's a utility, they're just going to add it on to costs for the ratepayers. And if it's one of the merchant plants like Vermont Yankee, where a corporation, an energy corporation, owns it, then they could just eventually, limited liability corporation, could walk away and leave what's left to be cleaned up by taxpayers. That Vermont, for example, is a little state. There's not even 700,000 people in Vermont. So how are they going to afford, when we look at it now, it's as much as $1,000 per man, woman, and child in Vermont to pay for the extra costs.
There's many subsidies in the nuclear industry. The Price-Anderson risk insurance, where the public assumes the risk of a nuclear power plant blows up. But the the hidden subsidy in the nuclear industry is decommissioning. What the Nuclear Regulatory Commission allows is that you don't have to dismantle a plant immediately. You're allowed to wait 60 years until you get enough money to decommission the plant. Well, in Vermont, we have to have a fully funded decommissioning fund when we build a windmill. But the Nuclear Regulatory Commission says Vermont Yankee can wait 60 years. I think a nuclear power plant's a little more dangerous than a windmill. You wouldn't allow a gas station to sit in your town with leaky tanks for 60 years. And yet the Nuclear Regulatory Commission looks the other way on nuclear power.
And here we're talking about a plant that hasn't blown up. Mm-hmm. Very often people say, oh yeah, accident, you have to pay extra. But that's not true for just a normal plant that's shut down because of old age.
No, that's correct. None of the externalities, the things left outside of the realm of operations, are included in the costs either. For example, the mining and the mining cleanup, or all of the ongoing waste storage and where to put it and how to transport it and how to guard it from terrorism attack. None of that is calculated in any of the operations costs.
There was a uranium mine in Utah, at Moab, Utah. And the company that built the mine had this enormous dam loaded with all the junk that's left over from mining. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission told them that they had to set aside $6 million to clean it up. That was the decommissioning fund required. And when they shut down, it turned out to be a $1 billion project. And the solution was they went bankrupt, and we, the citizens of the United States, got stuck cleaning up that mess. So when you hear about a nuclear power plant being cheap, the fuel is cheap, etc., it's because every accident and every mining disaster that they have are carried by the public, and only the successes get transmitted through in the cost of the fuel.
Taking into account what's being done with the waste, I mean, that's another supposedly subsidized program. Didn't the U.S. government take on responsibility to come up with a safe repository for the high-level waste?
Do you want me to answer
that? We'd answer it entirely differently. Go ahead, you start, and okay. Then I'll cut in.
When I get out of college, all the nuclear power plants in the country had fuel pools designed to hold 5 years of fuel. And the theory was that after 5 years, it would get shipped to a waste reprocessing facility and get turned right back around, and we'd make more fuel than we were using. It appeared to be endless, an endless cycle, a fuel cycle. In fact, it never was a fuel cycle. It was a fuel chain. It broke, and it starts and it ends, but it doesn't go round and round. So what's happened now is that we're storing all this nuclear waste in fuel pools, and as the fuel pools fill up, we're sticking it in dry cast storage. Now, in the 1980s and 1990s, the government stepped in and said, we'll take care of this nuclear waste. And they chose a spot in Nevada called Yucca Mountain. The reason they chose it has nothing to do with science, but it was because Nevada didn't have a lot of votes, and it was affectionately called the Screw Nevada Bill as it worked its way through the Senate and the House. And now Yucca Mountain's shut down because it doesn't seem to be technically correct, and politically it's unacceptable to the people who live in Nevada. And so we're stuck. We're storing all this waste above ground in dry cast storage for hundreds of years.
So Maggie, you have a different answer.
The technology simply does not exist. There is only one place in the world that believes that they have the technology, and that's in Finland. And they have dealt with building this huge underground bunker that has to hold the waste for 250,000 years, but they say they know it will only hold for 100,000 years. Plus, it's already filled and they're still operating many, many more nuclear plants and producing much more waste. So they are only going to be able to store for 100,000 years a fraction of their waste. Any of the technologies developed anywhere else in the world don't work. The U.S. was counting on a form of encapsulation for some of its materials. And that doesn't work. Sweden did tests that show that it breaks apart in 100 years. This waste is the gift that keeps on giving. And when we haven't even had people, humans, species with language in that for that amount of time, how are we going to anticipate if the mines, salt mines, or the granite facilities like in Finland are marked in 10,000 years? How will people even know if that says that this is no trespassing? Will they have that same language? Will they write the same way? Or even worse, will another Hitler come along and want to take that material and use it to create bombs?
Some of that has to do with mixed oxide fuel. Mm-hmm. That was supposed to be a recycling event.
I'll cover that in a second.
Okay.
You know, there's 100 nuclear plants in the country, and before we ever figure a place to put it, we're going to have 100 dumps around the country where this spent nuclear fuel is going to be stored for as long as 100 years. The reprocessing of nuclear fuel is really done for bomb making. The plutonium that comes out of the reprocessing is a significant contributor to the making of atomic bombs. The Indians made their atomic bomb from reprocessed fuel. The Pakistanis made their atomic bomb from reprocessed fuel. North Koreans from reprocessed fuel. And the most frightening one is that Japan has enough plutonium now to make 1,000 nuclear warheads if they wanted to. So we've got the new regime there run by a man named Abe. He's the prime minister. And he wants to remilitarize Japan. And it's really frightening that their reprocessing program from commercial civilian nuclear plants is enough to make 1,000 nuclear bombs if they want to.
And just as concerning, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, is encouraging them to keep doing this reprocessing. The people of Japan don't want that plant to continue anymore. It's been operating for years and years and years and still doesn't work properly and keeps shutting down. And the Department of Energy is still encouraging them to do it as well. So we see it as part of a remilitarization that helps the Asia-Pacific plan by the U.S. government.
Actually, that's a fascinating comment because I wonder how much it has to do with global trade agreements and what's hidden behind them politically. Is this part of a strategy to isolate China?
Yeah,
I think that's true.
Yeah. You know, the Japanese have a unique perspective on nuclear power. The first bomb on Hiroshima was an enriched uranium bomb. So that uranium came out of the mine, ran through an enrichment facility, and then got dropped. The second bomb on Nagasaki was a plutonium bomb from reprocessed fuel from the Hanford reactors. So we had a plutonium bomb and a uranium bomb destroy two cities in Japan. Then about 10 years later, the Americans were testing a hydrogen bomb in the Pacific, and 100 miles away was a ship called the Lucky Dragon 5. And the hydrogen bomb was 10 times more explosive than scientists thought. It threw up a huge cloud of radiation, killed a couple of the crew members on the Lucky Dragon quickly, and the rest died horrible deaths over time. And the State Department was terrified that Japan would not be amenable to taking our nuclear ships into their harbors or into Okinawa. So the American State Department made a deal with the Japanese and said, we'll give you nuclear power plants because they're good, atoms for peace. And it took the Japanese mind off of the fact that they had civilians die in a hydrogen bomb, in a uranium bomb, and a plutonium bomb. And then, of course, 30 years after that, they had the Fukushima Daiichi disaster. So as a country, they've experienced the whole gamut of problems with nuclear power. It's the beginning, I'm afraid, of a remilitarization of Japan. And they certainly have enough plutonium to become a world power in nuclear if they chose to be.
Actually, that reminds me of meeting an employee of the Hiroshima City paper. His job was to seek out nuclear sites, bomb or mining or nuclear power sites, and report on them to keep alive this thought that Japan would do everything it could to not have a repeat of this, of its own fate. Mm. Have you ever come across the very few people who are left in Japan who see that as their mission?
We have, with one of our board members, Chiho Kaneko, has translated at the UN for the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And she's worked extensively with some of them and has some real insight. And she did a beautiful blog post in Demystifying Nuclear Power, the blog on fairwinds.org on our website. And it brings you to tears to hear the stories. And she said, so much of this she never learned. They were never taught in school. And it's only in the last decade or so, as an international translator, that she's been able to learn this much about her country's own history.
You know, the bomb occurred in 1945, so 70 years have gone by. So it's only the very young people who are 20 years old or younger at Nagasaki and Hiroshima who are still alive to tell the story. We had one story where a young girl saw her father standing in line for medical treatment. And she went over and tugged on his sleeve, and it wasn't his sleeve. His entire skin rolled off his arm into her hand. He died shortly thereafter. I mean, this is a horrific way to destroy human beings. And I hope to heck it never gets tried again on this planet.
In a way, it brings us back to the issue that atomic nuclear power plants were really a result of bomb making.
Mm-hmm. Right. Nuclear power plants are a result of bomb making. They were the Atoms for Peace program, and the U.S. government tried to foster using them around the world. The technology was shared. Peaceful Atom was part of the Eisenhower program, even though President Eisenhower spoke against the militarization that we have now. And he said, never trust the military-industrial complex. And that is what we have, a military-industrial complex that uses the fuel to further bomb-making and to further the industries that support war around the world.
I'd love to ask you one more question.
Yeah.
The time at Fukushima, you probably will address it tonight, that it's even safe to approach it, much less to work on it, is on a totally different scale than 60 years.
The Japanese claim that they want to completely dismantle and eliminate all the radiation from the Fukushima site in the next 40 years. That's not going to happen. I was an executive in decommissioning of nuclear power plants, and when they're clean, it takes 10 or 20 years. And this site is anything but clean. The radiation levels are so high that not only will they kill a person, but they fry the electronics on the robots as they go into these areas. I also think it's terrible for the young Japanese men who will be working on the decommissioning because the regime, the current regime, wants to do it quickly. They really want to do it quickly to show the Japanese population that nuclear's safe, that we can get this done, we can get it behind us and move on. In fact, they're going to overexpose a generation of young Japanese men if they do that. My attitude is what the Russians did at the in the Ukraine on Chernobyl. Build a cover over it, let it sit for 100 years or more, and then go in. 100 years, the radiation exposures will be 10 or 15 times lower. So it's a good thing to wait if you're really concerned about the Japanese gene pool and the genetic damage to the workers that this massive cleanup will entail. On top of that, it's going to be $500 billion to clean it up. It's a mind-boggling amount of money. And the Japanese government doesn't want to admit that to its people because they'll turn against nuclear. There's too much money in the process, and Japanese banks have bankrolled these 50 plants that are presently shut down. They want their money back. And the Japanese government is going to make sure that happens by turning these power plants back on.
This was a conversation with Maggie and Arne Gundersen. I visited them in their guest cabin in Inverness, West Marin, just before their Fukushima update presentation in Point Reyes Station, California. The date was November 21, 2015. As I'm producing this program on the fifth anniversary of the Fukushima disaster in March 2016, Arne Gundersen is spending a month in Japan to assess the status of the cleanup. He writes reports and calls in updates from his tour. Even though polls show that at least 70% of Japanese do not want the nuclear power plants reopened that were shut down 5 years ago, the Abe government is determined to put many of them back online and has begun the process. Visit their website, fairwinds.org, for videos and podcasts, as well as blog posts on current events, expert witness reports on nuclear safety issues, a book list, media coverage, and much more. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.